Hi, good morning, everybody. First, thanks to Marty for inviting me to this interesting conference at this beautiful place. As you already see, my talk here is on multi-locus migration selection models. It means migration models where selection acts on multiple loci. And in several respects, my talk is actually an extension, or the results presented are an extension of those, of some of those which Tom showed us on Monday. However, my talk is not based on his talk, so it's not necessary that you recall his notation or understood all his results. Instead, I will highlight these results from a different perspective, slightly different perspective, and it's also going to be presented in a somewhat different way. So my interest in spatial models arose just a few years ago, actually for two different reasons. One reason is that for the last couple of years, I was interested in frequency-dependent selection and associative mating and its role in sympatric speciation. And a natural extension is, of course, parapatric speciation to include space. And the other reason why I got interested is a more long-term one, because for many, many years I've been working on mechanisms that can maintain genetic variation, in particular mutation selection balance and all that stuff. And so one of the basic central questions that one would like to understand is how important is population subdivision in maintaining genetic diversity. Now, when I actually started to work on spatial models just about 3 years ago, I started out with a very simple two locus model, derived some nice and, for me, surprising results, and then discovered, after Tom pointed this out to me, that these results were completely non-generic. So there obviously was a need to approach these problems of maintaining genetic diversity under certain realistic ecological scenarios. That's what I tried from a more general perspective. And so eventually I ended up in doing this work that I'm going to show you. Just a few words on multi-locus models of migration and selection. There has been very, very little work been done on that. I'm going to concentrate on models in discrete space and discrete time. And there's just a little bit of work from the 1970s. There, Christiansen and Feldman studied certain protection conditions, so related to the concept of a protected polymorphism on with a single locus and just two alleles. They tried to extend some of these aspects to two locus models, but they came up only with simple conditions for protection of a gamete and things like that, because the maintaining genetic diversity in the full two locus system is much more complicated because the boundary is multidimensional.
When Tom commented the two locus model is not generic, why is that? What's the gist of the argument?
What I did assume in that model in order to make progress, analytical progress, was to assume no dominance and no epistasis, and also the Levine model. And what I found there was, in fact, internal equilibria, but manifolds of internal equilibria. So every trajectory converged to some polymorphic equilibrium, but if you perturbed it only slightly, then this internal equilibrium would disappear and you had only stable equilibrium at the boundary. So the slightest perturbation would lead to loss of genetic variation. And this then convinced me to approach this problem from a more general perspective. And in the meantime, we understand this problem much better. But it's unlikely that I will find time to really talk on this at the end of my presentation. But we can discuss it if you like. And a second interesting result from the 1970s is by Lee and Ney, who showed that also in a two-locus model, stable linkage disequilibrium can be maintained without epistasis. You know, if you have a panmictic population and there is no epistasis, then there cannot be stable linkage disequilibrium. All trajectories converge to linkage equilibrium. These are classical results by Ewens and others. But once you have migration, and as it turns out, not too strong and not too weak, you can maintain stable linkage disequilibrium in the absence of any epistasis. And there's also a little bit more work on Klein's for the two locus case, initiated, I guess, by Slatkin, also mid-70s. But I'm not going to talk on Klein's at all, just on discrete time, discrete space models. So what we actually need to do in order to present all the results is first establishing the general model, which basically follows the same, uses very similar assumptions to those used by Tom and by others in the field. So what we consider through all of this talk is a diploid population with discrete and non-overlapping generations, and the sexes are indistinguishable. We assume that the population is subdivided into finitely many colonies or deams, and they exchange adult migrants. So we always assume migration of adults. In each deem, mating occurs, and it is random within each deem. In generalization of Tom's assumptions, we here admit more than one locus, so actually the number of loci is arbitrary, a finite arbitrary number, and also the number of alleles at each locus can be arbitrary, can be two or more. Selection is always frequency independent, it's viability selection, and it's constant in time. It acts in each deem separately, so selection may differ from deem to deem, of course. And mutation, random genetic drift, and any other complications are neglected in this model. So the strong forces here are selection and migration. Or to put it otherwise, the time scale is such that the alleles are given, and during the time scale considered, no new alleles pop up. So when approaching these general multi-locus models, there are a number of mathematical questions that must be addressed, and then of course also biological questions. So the mathematical questions concern of course the dynamical properties of the full system. Multi-locus systems are known to be rather complex and complicated, even if there is a panmictic population and only two loci and two alleles at each locus. And so the first question is, of course, what are the dynamical properties of multi-locus systems if there is migration and selection? what we would know in particular is, of course, that when is the dynamic simple in a certain way? Because we already know from the single log, because it can, from two logs without migration, it can be complicated. So the first natural question is, when is it simple? For instance, in the sense that one gets all this convergence to some equilibrium and no complicated dynamical behavior. Another important question for multilocal systems is, when does convergence to linkage equilibrium, or more generally to quasi-linkage equilibrium, occur? Because linkage equilibrium is interesting for biological reasons anyway, and it's also important for analysis of more complicated models, because if as soon as one knows that convergence to linkage or quasi-linkage equilibrium occurs, one can considerably simplify the analysis, because then it's more or less the loci are independent and one has a much bigger chance to actually prove concrete and explicit results. Of course, simple and positive answers to these questions can only be expected for simple genotype-phenotype maps and for special migration patterns. And what do I mean by simple genotype fitness maps? I mean that there is either no or weak epistasis and no or intermediate dominance. Why do I not consider, say, over-dominance or under-dominance? First, it's intermediate dominance is much more common than over-dominance or under-dominance. And over-dominance is known to be able to maintain genetic variation in a panmictic population. So it's of less interest to study overdominance in a subdivided population in order to understand under which conditions it's migration or the interaction of migration and selection that maintains genetic variation. So that's what I mean by simple genotype fitness maps. Of course, you could also include here the phenotype in between. And then say there's no weak epistasis in the genotype-phenotype map, and fitness acts on phenotypes in a simple way, also like more or less linear or not very strongly curved or whatever. And special migration patterns that I'm going to study are the following. First is that migration is strong relative to selection, so that's the strong migration limit. In fact, in order to get nice results, we will also need that recombination is strong, because if selection and recombination both are equally strong, then one gets all kinds of problems already in a panmictic population. The second case is weak migration, and the third case, although I'm just touching that topic at the very end, not presenting any detailed results because it's still work in progress, is that migration is independent of the team of origin, which is just the Levine model, which we already have seen in Tom's talks.
With your assumptions on the fitness landscape, would it be possible to treat something like Sympatric speciation, where you have a trait with a maximum in fitness?
But no. What I hope to do eventually is to deal with parapatric speciation, where, for instance, you have two deems and weak stabilizing selection in both deems, but different optima, things like that. Because this would lead to this, if the optima are sufficiently different, this would lead to disruptive selection. So that's kind of a long-term goal for the next 3 years or whatever. And part of a proposal for funding that I submitted a few months ago. So, as I already mentioned, the central biological question for this talk here is to find out under which conditions multilocus polymorphism can be maintained in a subdivided population when it is not the case in a panmictic one. And that's the reason why I exclude, that's one of the two reasons why I exclude strong epistasis, because with strong epistasis anything can happen in a panmictic population, and second, strong epistasis is difficult to deal with mathematically. And that's also the reason why over or under dominance are excluded. So more specifically, we are going to ask the following questions. Again, if there is no or weak epistasis and intermediate dominance at every locus and at every dean, how many loci can be maintained at the polymorphic can be maintained polymorphic at a stable or also unstable equilibrium? So the question is there any relation between the number of deans and the number of loci that can be maintained polymorphic? We already know that the number of alleles for a single locus may depend on the number of deans, depending on the migration pattern. Similar question for weak epistasis. And for a single locus, we've already seen that there's a generic upper bound here for the number of alleles that can be maintained. And the question is there a similar result for multiple loci? And is the number of loci arbitrary that can be maintained polymorphic? And then finally, a more specific question. If there's really no epistasis and no dominance, so it means that selection is completely additive, can we prove that the number of deans is indeed a generic upper bound for the number of alleles at any stable equilibrium? And the answer to this will be positive in some cases. In general, it's for general migration, it's not known. So what I next need to do before introducing talking about the results is talking about some notation. I guess it's not necessary that you memorize all the notation, because simply ask if you need something or forgot something, and I'm going to explain it verbally anyway when talking on the results. So capital L is always the number of loci. And if they are indices, then loci are always denoted by letters K and N. So at the locus N, the number of alleles is I sub N, it's always 2 or bigger. And alleles at locus N will be denoted by subscripts I sub N. So then this capital I is simply the number of all gametes that exist in this system, and that's important. Gametes are always subscripted by I and J. For the deans, I'm always using Greek numbers. Gamma is the number of deans. There should be at least one, of course, and with two it becomes interesting, I mean, different from the panmictic case. And specific deans are denoted by alpha and beta. Delta sub I is our simplex of gamete frequencies if there is a single dean. So it's a probability simplex of all gamete frequencies in a single dean. And delta I super gamma is then the state space of the full dynamics, so it's just the product of simplices, because for each deem, in each you have to follow the gamete frequencies in each deem, in each of the gamma deems. And alleles are denoted in that way, although it pops up only a few occasions. So the upper index K in parentheses indicates the number of the locus, so it's locus K. And I sub K is the number of allele at this locus K. We also need frequencies and things like that. So, as I already indicated, I is always a gamete, alpha is a deem, so p sub I comma alpha is the frequency of gamete I in deem alpha. We also need frequencies of alleles in deems alpha. We need linkage disequilibria, and I'm going to talk about linkage disequilibria in a minute or two. So again, that's the linkage disequilibrium in gamete I in deem alpha. It's important here that we only need linkage disequilibria within deems. We are not going to need linkage disequilibria between deems. We need fitnesses. So fitnesses are assigned to genotypes. IJ is a genotype consisting of gametes I and J in deem alpha. And M alpha beta is the coefficient of the backwards migration matrix. So it's the probability that an adult in deem alpha came from deem beta. And we assume that this backward migration matrix is ergodic. So ergodic means it's irreducible. You can get from every deem to every other deem in a finite number of steps. And it's aperiodic, so there are no periodicities, and that's a completely generic assumption. Of course, it's stochastic, so the rows sum up to one. What's going to play an important role, as in Tom's talk, is the principal left eigenvector. The leading eigenvalue is one, of course, because it's a stochastic matrix, and we'll need the left eigenvector, which describes actually the stationary distribution of the corresponding Markov chain. And the reason is that we will need to average with respect to this vector mu here. So and here's the averaging procedure, which is completely analogous to what Tom introduced 2 days ago. So for the strong migration limit, we will need this averaging, and we average the gamete frequencies in the deems with respect to this probability vector mu, and that's just written up in vector notation. So the capital uppercase P sub I is just the average frequency of gamete I in the whole population. And I'm always using vector notation. So the P then simply is the frequency in each of the gamete of the frequency of all the gametes. What's going to be very important is the deviation of the gamete frequencies from the average gametic frequency, and this is going to be denoted by Q. So P is the vector of allele of gamete frequencies in each deem, and the capital B, uppercase B, is the average frequency. So in some sense, this is a measure of spatial heterogeneity of the population. If Q is zero, then the population is spatially homogeneous. Otherwise, if Q is not zero, it's heterogeneous. And average allele frequencies are also denoted by uppercase P. So lowercase p is always gamete frequency in a deem. Uppercase P is average frequency of alleles or gametes. Linkage disequilibria in multilocus systems are always a little bit of unpleasant and complicated. But in this context, fortunately, they are not more complicated than in a panmictic population, because it's sufficient to follow linkage disequilibria in each deem and not linkage disequilibria between two deems. So what we actually need for those who are maybe not so familiar with linkage disequilibria in multilocus systems is... Okay. No reason to explain.
No, I'm just joking.
So we have more than two loci. Say 1, 2, 3, 4. And 4 is more or less as complicated as many. 3 is slightly simpler. And recombination in principle can occur between any of these pairs. So you can have recombination events here and there and there. You could have three recombination events, you could have two recombination events, you could have one recombination event. So what we actually need to do is to, say, and L, or maybe I should write it in this way, is the number of all loci. And this K and N is a non-trivial decomposition of the set of loci. So for instance, the set K would consider of these two loci, and the set N of the other two loci. And the CK then designates the probability of reassociation of the genes at the loci in the set K, which come from one parent, with the genes at N, at the loci in N that come from the other. So basically, what we need to do, if we have two parents, and if the offspring carries this and that, and this and that, then they get the K, the genes in K from one parent, the genes in N from the other parent. And we need the probabilities of all these combinations.
One thing, Rainer, as I remember, you have to normalize so that the first locus is in K. Of course, you could.
It has to be normalized. So, yeah.
It's not on the slide, so I thought.
It's not on the slide, no. One has to normalize and say, okay, the first one is female and the second is. The second is from the father.
So some of this complexity, this notational complexity, comes from working with diploids. So to what extent is it important for the kind of question you want to ask?
If you
population just working with haploids.
If you okay, it depends. It depends of it depends if the haploids are sexual or not. If they are asexual, then you don't need it. If they are sexual, then it's very similar.
Only the fitnesses would be similar.
For haploids that reproduce sexually, only the fitnesses would be simpler.
You just have a single index for the gamete. Otherwise, it would just as bad.
For asexuals, all this is irrelevant because you can treat asexuals as a single locus. And so this is one of the several sets of measures of linkage disequilibrium that has been introduced. And in the multilocus literature, at least six or seven different sets of linkage disequilibria have been introduced. If you're interested in comparing them and reading on their advantages and disadvantages, I can refer you to my book where most of them are treated. So for the purposes here, at least for writing up the recursions in a simple way, this is the most convenient set because then the recursions look very simple. Still, in order to work with the recursions, you have to work with these and transform these. And we'll see in a minute how they simplify if selection is absent. So if selection is absent and you have just recombination, then all these W's are simply one. And then you recover more or less the classical two locus. It's still more general than the two locus linkage disequilibria, but you recover the classical terms.
Do you need selection to be absent, or do you need it to have a similar epistasis? Because if you have
that's channel that work. This here works with and without epistasis.
Yeah, sure, but you said that without selection, you just that simplifies a lot.
Without epistasis, it doesn't simplify much. Without selection, it simplifies a lot. It becomes this. All the W's are one, and here you see what's going on. That's the frequency of the gamete I,
Can you turn the light off?
Sorry. That's the frequency of the gamut I. And that's the frequency of the gamut where the loci here in K are fixed. And that's where the complement is fixed.
If now the fitness was just as, you know, sum of these independent loci, then these W's you had on the other slides, they would be equal whether you partition them that way or not.
You still have a weighting by the W's.
The weighting remains. Sorry. The weighting remains, but. Yeah, but you can pull some of the term outside.
But for that, you don't need your assumption. See, those two thicknesses are equal if there's not position effect, as we call it. That's all you need for it.
Yeah, if there's no genomic imprinting, then it's simpler.
If this gamete and the one that's crossed over have the same thickness, then those two are the same. You don't need as strong an assumption, as you're saying.
Yeah.
Because you just think about what.
Yeah, then all this goes just before the sum.
I don't really understand why you can't just define the linkage disequilibrium the same way as you had on the one without the selection.
You
I
can.
I don't understand why you need to put selection into the definition of, you know what I mean?
You can, and I'm coming to this in 2 minutes. The reason why they are defined this way is to write down the recursion equations in a simple way. So here's the dynamics.
But then that's a quantity which is a kind of convenient mathematical quantity in the equations, right? Whereas if you're thinking of linkage disequilibrium as being a thing that you want, that
yes.
the property of what's linked to what, it's not obvious why you want to put...
It's not the same option.
In order to work with these equations, and actually depending on what you want to do, one may need to go to different sets of linkage disequilibria, and I will show you one of those in 1 or 2 minutes. But if you use the other set of linkage disequilibria, which is one of the sets which seem to be natural, then these equations are so complicated that if you write it up, it will be a full page.
Basically, it's happening because recombination is following selection, and that's why Reinhardt
yes.
writes a simple equation needs to have the thicknesses in the set.
So what we assume for the life cycle is that we have first selection, that's viability selection, then recombination, then migration, where this order is irrelevant because it's irrelevant whether meiosis occurs before you migrate or after you migrate, because it occurs within individuals anyway. So the complete selection, recombination, migration dynamics, and in the SQL it's always abbreviated as SRM, just consists of these two equations, steps. Yeah. The first one is linear. It describes the effect of migration on the allele frequencies after selection and recombination. And this here is the classical multilocus selection recombination dynamics. So it's just recombination and selection with multiple loci. And we are going to view this as a dynamical system on this product of simplices.
I would have thought naively that once you start generating correlations between the loci, the system will not close just on the level of pair correlations. You seem to be writing down...
No, we are not writing down any pairwise correlations, because pairwise correlations are clearly not sufficient.
Okay. So, I got lost. I thought I just heard the... that we were defining somewhat unusual giving a linkage disequilibrium somewhat unusual definition so that we'll be able to write a recursion relation for it.
but I wouldn't really expect to be able to write a closed recursion for basically a two-point object once we start generating correlations. We would also have to start looking at multi-point correlations.
Yeah, I mean, these linkage disequilibria describe statistical independence among genes. Actually dependence, but pair? No. Not among pairs. It's completely general. Pairs are not sufficient, of course.
Okay, I'll ask this later.
So it's a complete set of variables that describes any dependence.
So your definition included some.
It cannot be reduced to just linkage disequilibria or correlations between pairs. It includes triples, quadruples, any subset. And that's why it's so complicated.
Okay, fine. So I did not understand exactly what.
Because actually there are as many linkage. There are as many linkage equilibria as there are equations indeed, or independent variables.
It's just.
I don't understand, then why not just work with joint probability? We'll maybe discuss this after. Okay.
Would you respond?
Or do you wish to I variables?
No.
Okay. Reinhardt's complete set of variables are the Gamedic frequencies. For most purposes, it's been found since people have worked with truncated equilibrium, probably since the 1930s. For most biological questions or mathematical questions, it's more convenient. It's just a transformation of variables. I mean, you agree, right, that the way you started was the immediate frequencies. That's a complete set of variables and it's closed.
Absolutely.
Okay. Then all he's doing is a generalization of what I was showing you. When I went from the averages, in a way, the averages and the deviations. So what this is you go from the Gamedic frequencies, on the one hand, which are complete, to the gene frequencies and the disequilibria in HD. And that's complete, and you can count it. And the reason you don't have an excess of variables, I know that's not what you asked, is that certain sums of those disequilibria are zero. It's just a transformation of variables. It's not a two-point correlation.
But what we would like to understand is how do you combine the two-point, three-point, four-points, five-points all together? I mean, what's the combination of all these
that
correlations into a single point?
Yes. Well, it's a question of what you choose. So that capital D includes all of them, depending on what gamut you pick.
Yes.
But I guess the bottom line is, it is perhaps semantic, but I'm having a little trouble parsing the double sum there. And
this is much simpler.
As a measure of deviation from a factor, from factorization.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And now I think what you're telling us that this isn't it.
No,
that's
possible.
We are not factorizing the loci within the gamut. That we're working with the full distribution on the gamut space.
Well, that
not
is
not factorizing over loci.
The apprentices there, the pi alpha minus that product, that is a factorization.
That's exactly the factorization you're asking, but it's over all possible subsets.
So there's a vast amount of information in that capital D, and that's why it works.
If I'm going to sum over monomials, I can represent any function, and it's not a factorization, it's just a basis representing any function. So then, it's really just a change of variables, and you've got nothing to do with this sort of naive notion of a linkage disequilibrium, which has to do with deviations from.
Yes, it does. Okay. If all those parentheses are zero, you're a linkage equilibrium. That means for all subsets.
It means for all subsets, K and N,
So
I think we'll just have to go on the blackboard.
Your intuition is correct, but it has much more in it than.
I mean, it's not the kind of you would be looking for a kind of linearization or something like that, so that you really get that can be done using what is called Haldane's linearization.
Like the first correction to the factorized distribution. You know, of course, we can just subtract factorized distribution from a full distribution and just call whatever the difference. Give it a name. I really don't want to.
That's not contained solely in multiple parts.
Yeah, plus. So we just subtracted the product.
Yeah.
Okay,
fine. It's not possible to say two points.
Yeah,
so that's
fine.
That's what it is.
Okay, so after this introduction of the model and some of its basic properties, we're now coming to the main results. And the main results are divided in two parts. First, the dynamical properties, and then in the second part, maintenance of genetic variation and polymorphism as applications of the main theorems here. So we will cover three different models, assumptions. In the first case, we deal with the model of that there's no selection, so we study only migration and recombination, looking what's going on there. Then we make a kind of singular perturbation analysis and assume that selection is weak to relative to migration and recombination. And the third issue then deals with weak migration, where migration is weak relative to selection and recombination. And there we will also have to assume that epistasis is weak. So the first case is only migration and recombination, no selection. In this case, the dynamics of gametic frequencies becomes much simpler. It can be written in this simple form here, where M is the backwards migration matrix, that's the gamete frequency, and that's the linkage disequilibrium. And with no selection, the linkage disequilibria simplify to that, and it's a sum over all possible subsets, and you factorize the PI. Try to factorize it or approximate it by this difference here, PI minus all these possible products here. And we also need to recall for the following that our Q was a measure for the spatial heterogeneity of the population, so deviation from equal gamete frequencies everywhere. And here is the first result, which generalizes a classical result from multilocus theory. For a panmictic population, it has been known for long, and actually, I guess the first proof was given by Geiring in 1944, that if there is only recombination, then all trajectories converge to linkage equilibrium. And you have this linkage equilibrium manifold, which is a manifold of equilibria. And in the, also called the right manifold, and in the, most of you know the simple picture for the two locus, two allele case, where you have your simplex, your tetraeder, and the manifold hanging on four of these sides, and convergence occurs to this linkage equilibrium manifold. And here's the generalization for migration and recombination. And then there exists a manifold which is defined by the property that all linkage disequilibria are zero, and the population is spatially homogeneous. So the population can, on this manifold, the population can be described by the average gene frequencies. You only need the gene frequencies, and they are the same in all deams. So you can take gene frequency in one deem, and you have a point on this manifold, and all points on this manifold are just given by that, characterized by the gene frequencies.
And this is strong migration?
No, that's arbitrary migration. That migration is arbitrary, and it's still ergodic, so it's assumed to be irreducible and aperiodic. And recombination is such that all pairwise recombination rates are positive. There are no completely linked loci. And the mathematical result is that this manifold is invariant. So if you start on that manifold, you always remain on it. And it is globally attracting at a uniform geometric rate. So every trajectory converges to this, to one point on this manifold exponentially. And every point on this manifold is an equilibrium. So once you are there, you stay there forever. And that's, of course, a degenerate situation, because you have a whole manifold of equilibria. And once you are there, you stay there. So they are not isolated. And the rate of convergence can also be calculated. And it's the larger of these two quantities. So C min is the smallest two locus recombination rate. So it's 1 minus the smallest two locus recombination rate, or it's kappa. And again, generically, kappa is the modulus of the largest non-unit eigenvalue, where largest non-unit eigenvalue actually means you order the eigenvalues according to the modulus, and you take the second one. The first one is 1, and then you take the second one, which is less than 1. And the rate is generically, it's the large of... Pardon?
Eigenvalues of M, right?
Eigenvalues of M, yes. Kappa is the second largest eigenvalue of M. And if it's uniquely determined, if it's a double or triple eigenvalue, then you have to add an arbitrarily small epsilon to kappa. Then it's not kappa, but must be larger than kappa. But generically, it's this one. So I'm not going to talk much about the proof. Essentially, this uses a method of Tom devised in 1993 to deal with the case without with recombination and selection. So the structure and the idea of the proof is similar, although some of the details are significantly different. So the first thing one has to do is to get rid of this ugly capital D linkage disequilibria.
Yeah.
And by passing to a simpler set where you measure how far the gamete frequency deviates from the product of allele frequencies. The nasty thing is that you have to compute the little di in terms of the capital di, and you need the recursion, and these recursions are more than ugly, and I'm not writing them down. And then one proves that these linkage disequilibria decay to zero at the geometric rate. Or at least that's basically what one does, and then it follows eventually that the capital D's have the same property. One also needs a certain asymptotic invariance property of migration. So basically, if one applies migration to this product, to the whole product, and and substitute and subtract the product of the migration matrix applied to the gene frequencies, that this stuff converges to zero at the geometric rate. Once one has these recursion relations and this this property of migration, then one can eventually prove that the linkage disequilibria for any two locus subset converges to zero, and it's important that it's done for any embedded subset and not just for two fixed ones. And then there's a complicated proof by induction that extends it from two loci to multiple loci. And then the last step is, and for the last step, one already needs the decay of the linkage disequilibria. One can then also show that this spatial heterogeneity measure converges to zero at this rate. And so, and that's this result is going to present the basis for the next main results I'm going to present, and these are on strong migration and weak selection. That's in a similar way that if one deals in a panmictic population with weak selection, then one needs to know what's happening to the linkage disequilibria, and they are going to decay to very small quantities. So that's the second case. Then it's now strong migration, strong recombination, and weak selection. And that recombination is strong relative to selection is important here because it means it will imply that we actually converge to quasar linkage equilibrium. So linkage disequilibrium will become small, because if recombination and selection are both strong or equally strong, then one gets complicated behavior. So what we do in this case here is we basically fix the migration rates, we fix the recombination rates, and we write the fitnesses as 1 plus epsilon times selection coefficients. That's for each genotype and in each gene. And of course, we can restrict attention to selection coefficients, which are bounded by 1. And as already mentioned, the backward migration rates and the recombination rates are fixed here. And what comes next is this very simple differential equation, which is derived from the full complete dynamics by performing all these limits, letting epsilon go to zero. And rescaling time accordingly, and we call this the weak selection limit. And what is this weak selection limit? First of all, this weak selection limit basically lives on the manifold that I showed before to be invariant and globally attracting if there's no selection. So D equals zero and Q equals zero. And this weak selection limit describes how the average gene allele frequencies change. And that's a very simple equation, because that's essentially a product of single locus systems. That's because this is exactly the fitness, the average fitness of allele IN at locus N, and that's the mean fitness of the population, and that's the frequency of the allele. So that's completely analogous to the single locus multi-allele selection dynamics. And it's just that these omegas are defined in a different way. So these omegas here are the averages over the selection coefficients, and the omega bar is the mean selection coefficient of the population. And for further notation, I will always write p for the vector of the average allele frequencies. So that's all the allele frequencies. And I use pi for that. So this differential equation here, as I said, lives on this manifold and has a very simple structure and behaves as if we had just ordinary genic selection but a one locus system, actually a product of one locus systems on this manifold. The essential point for this proof is that this dynamics is very well understood and simple. In particular, it's a generalized gradient system, and mean fitness here is a Lyapunov function. So basically, that's the variance in fitness. And this is always non-negative, and equality occurs only at equilibria, or actually exactly at equilibria. And the fact that this is really a gradient system is essential for the following theorem, because the following theorem is kind of a singular perturbation argument. Because the weak selection dynamics is basically described as a perturbation of this simple selection limit on this manifold. But if there is no selection, that's a completely degenerate situation, because we have a huge manifold, and if you perturb a manifold, of course anything can happen. So the important point here is that this dynamics on this manifold is very simple, and therefore using deep arguments from dynamical system theory, one can prove that the full dynamics, if selection is weak, behaves as this simple limit on the manifold. And that's basically an argument that can be found in a paper by Tom together with Josef Hofbauer and Pavel Brunovsky in 1999. So, and here's the theorem, which is completely analogous to one of the results Tom showed you. So what we need to assume in order to perform this perturbation argument is that in this weak selection limit, all equilibria are hyperbolic. But we know if we have a single locus system, then usually we have finitely many equilibria unless we have special relations among the thicknesses. So generically, all equilibria are hyperbolic, and usually there are a few of them. And we assume that selection is sufficiently weak, then we denote the set of equilibria of this weak selection limit by psi 0. And because of this hyperbolicity assumption, this contains only isolated equilibria, finitely many. And the result says that the set of equilibria of the full system contains also only finitely many isolated points. And of course, as epsilon tends to zero, each equilibrium in the full system converges to a corresponding equilibrium in the very simple system on this manifold. And also the other way around, all equilibria occur in pairs, so to each equilibrium in the simple system, to each equilibrium in the simple system corresponds exactly one equilibrium in the full system, if selection is small, and stability is always the same. Either both are stable or both are unstable. And that holds even at the boundary for unstable equilibria, because here migration is strong, and no new equilibrium cannot be lost here. And the last result, which is by far the deepest, because these here could be obtained basically by simpler perturbation arguments, by local perturbation arguments, is that in fact every solution of the full system converges to one of the equilibrium points. So the dynamics, the whole dynamics of the full system is not more complicated as the simple dynamics on this degenerate manifold. That's the essential result of this, which means that for biological applications, and I'm treating one of these cases in the second half of the talk, it means that if migration is strong, we can, for many calculations, then assume that we have more or less linkage equilibrium, the gene frequencies are very simple, so simple perturbation results, a simple perturbation method then could actually be used to calculate concrete equilibria and whatever. And we know that we have convergence.
Do you have any results or intuition as to the radius of convergence of this? Do you expect that this sort of behavior persists at any strength of the stasis, or you expect something else?
Epistasis does not, there are no assumptions concerning epistasis here because selection is weak, but if selection is not weak, it's definitely wrong. And a counterexample is actually presented by this old two locus, two allele example by Lee and Ney, who showed partially numerically, the example was numerical, but everything
so
is analytical.
Even for an additive.
Yes. That one gets strong linkage disequilibrium.
But on the other hand, your sort of perturbative results here, presumably, the local stability would also apply for weak epistasis.
Yes. Yeah. So we shall also see that with weak migration, one usually is close to linkage equilibrium. And if one looks at the plots, at the figures in this paper of Lee and Ney, one really sees that for strong and for weak migration, there's almost no linkage disequilibrium. It's only for intermediate strengths of migration.
Weak selection is stronger than weak epistasis. If you meant by what you said, if your only assumption is weak epistasis, then no, that doesn't go. When you said it would apply to weak epistasis, do you mean that selection can be stronger than epistasis weak?
No, then it's only true if migration is weak.
Yeah, so Reinhard, weak selection is stronger than weak epistasis, right?
It's okay, a stronger assumption. I understand. So, okay, yeah, so that was the counterexample, right? No epistasis, but strong selection already broke down.
Yes.
Yeah. And we will also treat the case strong selection, weak epistasis, right, and weak migration. Then something similar is true.
Yeah, sure.
But strong migration and a strong non-epistatic selection, then it's wrong. It can be wrong. So what's interesting, not only from a mathematical point of view, but also for potential applications, is that the theorem, or rather its proof actually, shows that after a sufficiently long, but still evolutionary short period, as we shall see, the full selection recombination migration dynamics can be interpreted as a perturbation of this weak selection limit. And in particular, such a manifold is approached on which there's, how is it, it's called quasar linkage equilibrium since Kimura, and solutions are spatially quasi-homogeneous. Okay, I'm not going to say much about the proof because there's no time, but it uses deep results used in that paper, and this paper uses deep results from dynamical systems theory. Yeah, and finally, mentioning for a single multi-allelic locus, this was one of the results that Tom introduced on Monday. A few consequences is also mentioned by Tom. The time which is required to approach this quasi-linkage equilibrium and spatially homogeneous manifold is quite short. It's given by the logarithm of these two quantities. So epsilon is the strength of selection, and lambda is the leading eigenvalue which determines the rate of approach to this manifold. And also, if the gene frequencies are bounded away from the equilibrium of the weak selection limit, then mean fitness is increasing. So we can draw exactly the same picture that Tom had. If here is our manifold, and somewhere here is this other manifold, and if here is an equilibrium of the weak selection limit, and here is an equilibrium of the of our true full system, then trajectories are going to converge like this, and from here until here, and that's the long time span, mean fitness is increasing. So during the first generations, mean fitness is not necessarily increasing because linkage disequilibria are going to decay, and the population is going to become spatially homogeneous. But then mean fitness is increasing for a long time period, and only once we are extremely close to the equilibrium, then one can no longer prove that mean fitness necessarily increases. But for most of the time, mean fitness is going to increase. Well, most of the time, if time is infinitely long, is not a very precise statement. Shall we have a break now or in 10 minutes?
Can I ask what it would be like? Would it make sense to finish this?
Yeah. Okay. Because then the second half will be much shorter than the first half. Okay, so that's the third case. Now we assume weak migration, weak epistasis, but non-epistatic selection can be strong, or actually must be strong. And also recombination needs to be strong. So the weak migration perturbation is much simpler than the one with weak selection, because if there is the weak migration perturbation, it's a perturbation of a system where there's no migration, and that's simple. That's not degenerate. That's a much simpler perturbation. So in the absence of migration, we just have disconnected deams, and in each deam, the population is evolving in a panmictic way. And in each deam, the dynamics is given by the classical multilocus selection dynamics. So we have gamma decoupled multilocus selection dynamics in each deam. And without further assumptions, it is known that this can be complicated because limit cycles and all kind of stuff can appear. So in general, it's impossible to use perturbation arguments to derive the dynamics of the full system under weak migration, because perturbation results can only be used if the dynamics in each deam is simple in a certain sense. And one of the cases where it is simple is when epistasis is weak. So what we assume here now is weak migration. So the backward migration matrix basically is the identity matrix plus some small migration rates. And of course, this matrix A here, I'm going to call it capital A, has the property that all the entries here should be zero or bigger, and they sum up to they sum up to zero. And so the migration matrix then is written as I plus this A. So in order to deal with weak migration, we bound all the elements in this matrix A by an epsilon. And in order to deal with weak epistasis, we write the fitnesses as sums over the single locus fitnesses. So that's this U here is just the fitness of allele IN, JN at locus N in deem alpha. And we sum over all loci. Plus a residual term which describes epistasis. And we assume that this residual term is bounded by some small number eta. And this eta is actually a function of epsilon. So and this function gamma here is a simple function. It's continuously differentiable. And if epsilon is zero, then eta must be zero. So if there's no migration, then this the epistasis must be absent. And what this means here actually is that migration and epistasis both must be weak, but they must not be equally, they are not necessarily equally weak. So a special case, one special case would be that instead of eta, you take epsilon, then they are equally weak. But you could also take epsilon equals zero, for instance, then there's no epistasis at all. And anything in between is admitted. So migration and epistasis are both weak, but not equally weak. And again, for simplicity, we collect all additive fitnesses into a vector, a matrix, or whatever you want. It's irrelevant. It's uppercase U, and the full fitness is W. So basically, this W consists of the U and plus the R. But I didn't write that up. So, and here's the main theorem then, which is in some sense similar to that we saw before. So we suppose that in the absence of epistasis, so if epsilon is zero, then every equilibrium of the no migration limit is hyperbolic. So because what we have to do again is to exclude cases where alleles have exactly the same fitness, because this will lead to manifolds of equilibria, and they don't behave nicely under perturbation. So we have to make sure that all alleles have different fitnesses, and if that's the case, it's a generic assumption anyway. So if you sample the U's randomly with probability one, you will get a hyperbolic system. And all the recombination rates are fixed, and the epsilon is sufficiently small. And then for every set of fitnesses, where the W now consists of the U's, the additive thicknesses plus the residuals from epistasis, and where the matrix M basically is the identity matrix plus something small, we get the following. So again, this perturbation result, the equilibria of the no migration system are simple in that case. There are finitely many equilibria. And that's actually Ewens' result, isn't it? Basically, it follows from Ewens.
Which one? Sorry.
If there is no epistasis and no migration, that there are just there are finitely many equilibria and mean fitness is increasing. That's just multiple low service additive fitnesses.
I think you proved that mean fitness is increasing. I'm not sure about the rest of it. Maybe Carwin and his
team. Okay. But anyway,
he certainly didn't prove convergence.
He certainly did not prove convergence because that was proved only by Ljubic and Akin and Lozat much later. But anyway, if there is no migration and there is no epistasis, then the dynamics in each of the beams is well understood. So the set of equilibria contains only isolated points, and therefore the set of equilibria of the perturbed system with weak migration and weak epistasis also contains only isolated points. And again, as epsilon tends to zero, then each equilibrium of the full system converges to a corresponding equilibrium in the no migration system. And other way around, it's a little bit more complicated. So again, if you have an asymptotically stable equilibrium of the unperturbed system, then there exists an asymptotically stable equilibrium of the perturbed system in its neighborhood. But if you have unstable equilibria, that's true only for internal equilibria, but not necessarily true for boundary equilibria. So if you have an unstable boundary equilibrium in the non-migration, in the no-migration case, then with migration, this equilibrium may disappear. And there are simple examples can be found in the old literature in Carlin and so on. So in this sense, there's some difference to the strong migration limit that boundary equilibria can be perturbed in such a way that they leave the biologically reasonable or sensible state space. And again, one obtains convergence of all trajectories to equilibrium points. So again, the full dynamics is qualitatively the same as the very simple dynamics in the absence of migration.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So originally, unstable boundary equilibrium. So the initial data, of course, was still away, right? If you have a small migration, it goes out of the serial syntax. Then what happens to dynamic there? That initial data still close to the places. You know what I mean, right?
You mean if...
It's a 17 year dynamic, right?
No, but on the boundary, it's an unstable equilibrium, and this can go away. But I guess it depends if it's externally stable or not.
That's right, yeah.
It goes away as soon as you turn on migration.
Right.
So it was unstable to. Well, it has to be externally unstable, I think.
It has to be externally unstable, right. Yeah.
So, okay, I understand.
Okay.
So before that, it was going away anyway.
Right.
And it just keeps going away after the equilibrium has moved out.
Okay. So
the internal stability doesn't have anything to do with whether it's going to move outside, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the picture is that. But if you had any
the face portrait doesn't change that much. That's what I asked.
If you had an unstable equilibrium and the flow was this anyway, so after the perturbation, it's going to be outside, and the flow still goes away there. So, because I mean, the flow would go this way. So, okay. It's impossible to describe the proof. Again, it's based on results in that paper, and of course it's a generalization of what Tom mentioned in his first talk on Monday. There are just a few words. There are many other interesting limiting cases that could be studied or that one would like to study. But in some cases it's hopeless, and in some cases one gets at least partial results. So one of the interesting cases where one can prove a little bit is strong migration and weak selection and weak recombination. Then one can show that one converges to spatial quasi-homogeneity. But since selection and recombination are both more or less, can be both equally strong or equally weak, you don't get linkage equilibrium or whatever. And you may even get complicated limiting behavior. But it still can be shown that under strong migration, the population is well mixing over the deems and becomes homogeneous. And other case, which is quite simple, is if selection and migration are strong and recombination is weak, then the limiting case is essentially a single locus migration model. And if migration and selection are weak and recombination is strong, then again one obtains a dynamics which is basically the slow evolution limit for a single locus. So you simply get the differential equations for a single locus. And the final case, if all evolutionary forces are weak, then you get the differential equation version of our full dynamics. It's just then that migration, selection, recombination, and migration are decoupled terms in the equations, so which makes it much simpler. So the linkage disequilibria are much simpler. The W's disappear from the linkage disequilibria, and migration and selection become decoupled.
So what do you mean they are all weak? Some of them set the set time scale, don't
you? Yeah, you have to scale the time, and you scale fitnesses. I mean, like 1 plus epsilon something, and you do the same. And you do the same with the.
The rescale, then they're all strong. So that's what I don't understand. So what's the notion of weak here when they're all the same mode of fact?
Because you start in a discrete model.
Oh, so basically it allows you to take the continuous time limit.
Yes, you take the continuous time limit. Exactly.
I mean, intrinsically, the discrete model has a time scale of 1.
Yeah, which makes it rather
and then weak has a meaning.
Yeah, so you scale all three forces in the same way, and you rescale time, and as a consequence, you get the continuous time approximation, and all these in these equations, all the interaction terms that occur, they disappear. You just have a selection term, a migration term, and the recombination term. So in that sense, it's much simpler.
Does that involve some assumptions about epistasis or dominance?
No, nothing. But once you have this continuous time limit, you can prove analogous of the results I showed above.
Yeah.
Pardon?
And the stasis would somewhat couple recombination and selection, wouldn't it? So I don't see how they can be coupled.
If you write down the recursion equations, they are decoupled. But still, in this system, you could have limit cycles and all that.
You mean it's not that the genome decouples? So
No.
It's
It's just the equation consists of three separate terms: one describing selection, one migration, one recombination. Because in the discrete time model, they're always intertangled because one acts after the other. But in discrete time, they are separate. They occur. Yeah. But the dynamics again can be complicated. But what can be done for the continuous time model is prove analoga of the theorems I showed you just under the same assumptions. But the proof, for the continuous, it's like weak epistasis or whatever. So if epistasis is weak, then you can prove.
Have different epsilons there, and one would be smaller.
Exactly.
Isn't this a reasonable starting point? Because you just say that none of these forces has very strong effect in a single generation.
What was your question?
Well, the question was, why does one insist on sort of doing this discrete thing when sort of it's obviously that point number four is much easier in some sense, because or maybe it's not.
It is.
So
and presumably as far as most of the results here are concerned, you'll recover them in the continuum limit, and perhaps the difference is that there are some limit cycles, there are some oscillations that can happen in the discrete model, which
cannot happen in the continuous time model.
But you're not really you don't have sort of a hell of a lot of results about that regime anyway.
That's true. Yeah. But we, in principle, we had this discussion 2 days ago on the relation between the discrete time and the continuous time models.
If you want to start at the last point and you want to be biologically rigorous, you won't write the equations that Reinhardt is talking about because you have deviations from Hardy-Weinberg proportions. So you have an enormous increase in dimensionality. And you have to make another very complex, long argument and get this as an approximation. And for the theorems that Reinhardt has, it wouldn't be that much easier to use the ODE. What you've presented.
Yeah, no.
So,
no.
But it's not biologically rigorous to start.
But the proof in your paper, 1999, would be simpler.
Yes.
Because you don't need these discretization procedures.
Yes. You see, you have two points of view. I argued, trying to convince you that it's preferable to start discretely and make an approximation to get to continuum. The other point of view is you want to start in continuous time, but then you have to be biologically rigorous. Continuous time means that generations overlap. The population is evolving, so you don't have Hardy-Weinberg because you have a superposition of different gene frequencies. So I have some very old papers where I deal with that because I couldn't understand how people were writing these continuous equations just for gene frequencies and gene frequencies. So I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's not rigorous biologically because you can actually reason out what the equations should be with overlapping generations, and they're much more complicated than those.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is that it might be interesting to look from the point of view of the results, because if for that subset of results that are not recovered sort of in this continuum limit, then that they would probably be rather specific. And
I have no objection to examining that system and finding out whatever you can find out, but you were asking why not just start there. And ultimately, you wish to, at least from my point of view, that's what I tried to argue Monday, get results for a system you can justify biologically. And And the only way to justify that system, well, there are two ways. One is the way Reinhardt did and I did to start discreetly. The other is the one you haven't seen, but I can give you references if you like, which is to a priori reasoning continuous time, and then you have overlapping generations, and you, in this case, you would get something much, much more complicated because you have multi-locus genotypic frequencies. Because most of us don't really consider the haploids are very important. For haploids, it would make very little difference. That is true. But for diploids, it's just not the optimal way, in my opinion, to profile. But once you have the equation, it's great to do anything you can do with it. But you were asking why not just start.
Yes. If I understand Michael's argument, he would just look at that list and say, you know, start to discrete, and then it's reasonable.
Well, not the right discrete results at all, you mean.
It seems reasonable to say that all these forces are weak on the time scale of a generation, and then boom, we take a continuum limit, and we simplify some of the arithmetic.
Yeah, but these are stronger results than I present.
I mean, as long as one can prove something for discrete time without much more efforts than for continuous time, there's no reason to start out with the continuous time model.
Right. I mean, from the results, sort of in physics, we have a classification of those results that are sort of maintained in the continuum limit, and the rest we call lattice corrections. And we have sort of a notion of two classes of results. So I guess something like this must be here too, that some subset of the results sort of is invariant under whether you choose line four or one of the.
But you always, but you know only afterwards.
On the yeah. System, on the specific.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been using continuous time models many, many times. Tom has been using them. I mean, sometimes it's simply reasonable because you can't do anything for the discrete time model.
But I mean, if the migration rates are 40% and the selection coefficients are 20%, these aren't going to be corrections. The continuum is going to be far away, so I wouldn't call it, it's not like a small correction. Mm-hmm. And also, that last one works only if recombination is slow. So you will not be able to look at loci that are far apart, right? Because then the C's can yep. be, as well, for different chromosomes, they're half. I think it's fairly limiting. It's worth some extra effort if Reinhardt improves things. I agree. Mm-hmm. More generally, because weak recombination limits the biology, and if you look at the, I would yield to Marty on this, but my impression is, if you want to focus on a specific trait, say human height, the loci that control it aren't that strongly clustered, if at all. So you can't say I'm going to look at people's height, so all the loci will be close to the limit, right?
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely. So you just don't want to restrict yourself to very slow recombination if you don't have to.
Can I ask a slightly ignorant question? But just talking about what you mean by weak mathematical notion, maybe relative to water, something like that. In the rescaled time, apparently is weak. Just numerically, does it turn out that these approximations hold on a time scale that's shorter than something like 1/1 mutation rate? And that, maybe that's like a numerical.
One of the mutation rate is too long.
Like the biological, because there's a biological thing, there's no mutation in this process. And
I mean, one over the mutation rate is very long.
What's that?
Because that's 10^5 or 10^6 generations.
Yeah.
something like that.
It's one out of the mutation rate in the whole.
I would have answered that when we say in this type of work, the epsilon, for the reason you said, we would prefer to have 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3. It's not more, because we don't want mutation to be important, that mutation exists.
Right.
So,
okay.
So I would be uncomfortable with anything starting to work beyond 10 to the minus 4, because I think that's too long a time scale to have a long example.
Right. Okay, so it's
kind of
like down
the way. Yeah.
I mean,
mathematically, that doesn't appear, because you don't have it. You're asking extremely good biological question.
I mean, I've done some numerical work, but long ago, both for discrete and continuous time models, and so my rule of thumb was if the selection coefficients are of the order of 5 to 10%, then it's still good.
No, but you're asking in the other direction, how low they can get.
Yeah, low they
can get. So they should
be much. When you do numerically, you say maybe you might.
You don't.
You can't say minus two.
Yeah.
But still.
But theoretically, all the rates should really, I would say by an order of magnitude, if you wanted to say,
at least
exceed the limitation rate.
Right.
Yeah, at least.
So that you actually see what is being said by the theorems,
right,
in principle.
Let's have a little break for 15 minutes, or what do you suggest?
10
minutes? Okay, so now we come to the second and much shorter part, dealing with some of the applications I had in mind, and all of them deal with the maintenance of multilocus polymorphism. And I've been treating three cases: strong migration, weak migration, and the Levine model, where I'm not going to treat the third case here in this talk, because mainly it's still work in progress, though I can answer questions on it and mention that some results in this Levine model are different from what one gets for either strong or weak migration. So, what's about maintenance of polymorphism if migration is strong? What I proved actually is that for two beams or more beams, arbitrarily many alleles can be maintained at arbitrarily many loci at the stable equilibrium. So under strong migration, you can have as many loci as you want, that each locus as many as alleles as you want, and it's still possible to find a stable equilibrium where you have all alleles at all loci present. And this does neither require epistasis nor overdominance or underdominance. And of course, but it turns out, however, that it's impossible if there is no epistasis and no dominance. So one needs some dominance or some epistasis. But it's impossible if there is neither epistasis nor dominance, as in that case something very simple is going to happen. So that's the first main result. The number of loci here should be at least one. More interesting is, of course, the cases 2, 3, 4. Just two deams, because if we have the result for two deems, then we have it for many. And at least two alleles at every locus. and the recombination rates are fixed and positive, and we suppose the full selection recombination migration dynamics. Then what we can prove is the following, that there exists an open set in the parameter space of all migration and selection parameters, such that for every parameter combination in this set, we obtain a system which has a uniquely determined internal equilibrium, and all trajectories converge to that equilibrium. So you have, we have a fully polymorphic equilibrium where all alleles are present at all loci, and it's globally asymptotically stable. And moreover, we know that this equilibrium is going to be in quasi-linkage equilibrium, so it's not far from linkage equilibrium. It's quasi, spatially quasi-homogeneous, and it's globally attractive. That's something we've already said. And actually, this set of parameters can be further restricted, so the conclusions remain true if there's no epistasis at all, just additive selection, and some partial dominance. There needs to be dominance at least at one locus and in one dean. So in the absence of dominance, that's not possible. So that's a kind of surprising result, because if one constructs this set of parameters, and that's the basis of the proof, to construct this set of parameters, and this construction shows you, gives you an indication of when this is going to be true. The construction basically works this way, to assume, say, if there are two deans, so it follows an idea of Nagy-Laki and Liu. We have two deans, and in the simple case of two alleles, one could display it like this: the fitnesses of one, fitnesses are something like this. So these are two homozygotes that the heterozygote, the fitness of the heterozygote needs to be sufficiently close to the fit the homozygote, and the other way around in the other gene, so that on average, if you average these fitnesses, you get overdominance. So that's what's necessary in order to construct such an equilibrium. But you have to do it for all alleles and at all loci.
So it's not really quite like asking maybe this analogy to Gillespie's model, this concave fitness function, which is essentially the same on the fitness scale. The heterozygote is
And you, what one does not get this overdominance if they are just in between. That's not sufficient. So it must be sufficiently close to the higher homozygote in order that you obtain this. And of course, as you increase the number of alleles and the number of loci, these conditions become increasingly stringent. So of course, to maintain many alleles requires quite strong restrictions on the parameters. So, but the point here is, open set means that it indeed has positive measure. So if you sample your parameters randomly, you have a positive probability of finding that. It's not something that is non-generic and you need a special relation. So it is an open set of parameters, so it has a positive probability, but as the dimension of the space increases, I mean, this becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. Oh. Yeah, I already said everything about the proof I wanted to say, and how the proof works is of course using these perturbation theorems, because one first shows it for the simple case of one proves it for this weak selection limit in the absence of epistasis, and then by the perturbation results one actually shows that it blows up to a set of positive measure. And it's also interesting then that this theorem still holds if migration is restricted to the Levine model. So this open set of parameters is such that it also contains a certain subset of the Levine model. So if in the Levine model you have relatively weak selection and this kind of dominance, you still get that. Because the Levine model is of course consists of a very small subset in the parameter space, because in the migration matrix all rows are identical. So it's a very small submanifold of the whole parameter space, but it cuts through that open set. This theorem does not hold in the absence of dominance. So in fact, if there is no dominance, then one gets a complementary result. So I formulated here only for no epistasis. And sufficiently weak selection. So if one, this theorem says that one gets a globally asymptotically stable monomorphic equilibrium if fitnesses are either additive, it is there's no dominance, or for instance multiplicative. This includes the asexual case, this includes the haploid case, and more generally it also holds for deem independent degree of dominance. So it's essential to have sufficiently much partial dominance in order to maintain all these alleles, but with no dominance or multiplicative fitnesses. Well, of course, anything lower, if the heterozygotes are lower than the homozygotes, then it doesn't work. And that's important to remember, that if there is no dominance for strong migration or weak selection, then all genetic variation is lost. That's going to be wrong in the weak migration case. For weak migration, one can maintain genetic variation, as we shall see in a minute, if there is no dominance. No, that's actually for arbitrarily many deems. I mean, I formulated the result before the main theorem only for two deems, but the many deems case follows again from the perturbation argument. You can add many deems which do basically nothing, because they are either so small or selection is nearly neutral there. When they,
the reason I'm asking is because when you add the number of deems, then if you increase the migration a little bit, it will make a difference. That's why. But because you're seeing weak migration, so maybe the number of deems doesn't really
matter. No, it's weak selection. It's strong migration. It's the strong migration case. So basically, in the weak selection limit, it reduces to a single locus system. And then in a single locus system, if you have no dominance, you one gamut wins, and that's exactly what's happening here. So the second case is weak migration. Here we have to assume, in order to apply our theory, and that's again from the standpoint of maintenance of variation, the interesting case, weaker no epistasis, because with strong epistasis anything can happen anyway. And intermediate dominance, that in this case there can be arbitrarily many loci maintained polymorphic, but the number of alleles cannot exceed the number of genes, at least generically. So in principle, under weak migration, less than the number of alleles that can be maintained is lower than under strong migration. At least the maximum number of alleles is lower than under strong migration. But again, the number of loci that can be maintained polymorphic is arbitrary. So thus, generically, it's impossible to maintain more alleles than there are genes. And so in some sense, these two theorems contradict the general belief, opinion, that it's easier to maintain variation and polymorphism under weak migration than under strong migration, because in principle, under strong migration, we can maintain more. But in order to maintain the variation here, as many alleles as there are genes, you need much less stringent conditions than to do it under strong migration. Because in order to maintain all alleles, it's sufficient that each of the alleles is the best in one of the genes. If you have this, then you have as many alleles as genes. If one allele is the best in one of the genes in each, so then you get as many alleles as there are genes. But there is otherwise, there's no restriction on the dominance relation, for instance. It's just that for each gene you need an allele that's the best, and each of the alleles has to be the best. And then they are, there are still additional assumptions, but it's relatively weak compared to what happens under strong migration. Yeah, I guess it's not necessary to go through all the details. So again, for this weak migration case, one can prove that there exists such an open set of parameters. For the parameters, you have the W, the fitnesses, and the M. The M here is in the set of migration matrices with weak migration. So basically, you have the diagonal and something small and small migration rates. And the fitnesses are such that there is weak epistasis. Anyway, that's you again get an open set of parameters in the full parameter space, which is concentrated in the region where migration is weak. And one obtains a fully polymorphic asymptotically stable equilibrium, provided that the number of genes is at least as large as the maximum number of alleles at any of the loci. So in order to maintain all alleles at every locus, you need to have more genes. Yeah? That's the main difference. So the number of alleles is bounded by the number of genes, but not the number of loci. And this set of parameters can be chosen such that you have this kind of intermediate dominance for genotypes. So the IJ type is always between the II and the JJ type, or the other way around in each of the genes. And you still get an open parameter set if one restricts fitnesses to be non-epistatic and to display partial dominance. So So even if you start out your parameter space just with non-epistatic fitnesses, you still get such an open set. And that's actually how the construction works. You start by working with the non-epistatic case and then use the perturbation arguments to get it for the full space. We do not know yet how big, in some sense, these sets are in the full parameter space. This would require extensive numerical work that may happen in the future, but that's going to depend on money and people. So concerning, I already mentioned the more or less both of these points, but would like to reiterate it. So in contrast to the case of strong migration, here the number of alleles that is maintained cannot exceed the number of deams. And also in contrast to strong migration, here absence of dominance is admitted. So you don't need special dominance relations. It has not to one doesn't need any kind of overdominance in this sense, or average overdominance. So more or less any intermediate level of dominance is admitted to maintain as many alleles as you have deems. And I also mentioned this, that it's counterintuitive to have more polymorphism under strong than under weak migration. But I already mentioned that the proofs indicate that the conditions for maintaining the alleles at the locus under strong migration is much more stringent than under weak migration. And one can actually prove a little bit more, and I'm just going to mention that. So one can really prove that if migration and epistasis are both sufficiently weak and one admits only partial dominance, then it's always the case that the number of deems is a generic maximum for the number of alleles. So that's a little bit more general than what we had. I mean, the theorem basically told that this maximum number can be attained on an open set, and this tells you that it's impossible to get more unless you have some non-generic relations between your parameters. And again, for a single multi-allelic locus, this was essentially proved by Tom and Yuan just a year ago. And a very final remark concerning the Levine model, which in some sense behaves differently, because in all the results we have seen, there's no relation between the number of loci and the number of deems, or the number of polymorphic loci and the number of deems. There's a relation between number of alleles and deems. But in the Levine model, the situation changes. In the Levine model, there are situations where the number of loci that can be maintained polymorphic actually depends on the number of deems. So for instance, and this refers back to where I started in the Levine model for a very specific case. In the Levine model, if there is no dominance, then you are in a very non-generic situation. Non-generic situation. And if there is no dominance in the Levine model, then the number of loci that can be polymorphic, even with two alleles, so it's always less than the number of deems. So in the Levine model, the number of polymorphic loci is at most gamma minus one, even if you want to maintain only two alleles. If one considers arbitrary intermediate dominance, you know, like this case, for instance, if selection is weak in the Levine model, then you can get arbitrarily many alleles at arbitrarily many loci. But with no dominance, the number of loci is bounded by the number of deans minus one, which is kind of a strange result.
No intuition, for it. It's just a result.
Yeah. No intuition. And in the non-generic case, where the number of loci is at least as large as the number of deans or larger, then one can prove one gets manifolds of equilibria. So you can converge to a polymorphic equilibrium, but it's always a manifold which is somewhere, connect some of the faces or whatever. But it's an unstable situation, because if you perturb it, it vanishes, and you are back to the boundary. And so that's still something we try to understand, and eventually I actually hope to be able to use some of these results to study, for instance, stabilizing selection in two deans or more deans with different optima, and looking at conditions when you get something like symmetric speciation, because you get strong divergence between the deans, and when you conditions, of course, when you don't get it, and things like that. So that's the end of my talk. I just wanted to thank in particular Tom, who shared many of his unpublished results for the last couple of years, and we had numerous discussions and exchange of excessive faxes and email, and also to Josef Hofbauer for some very helpful discussions in reassuring that my proofs that involved some of his results on dynamical systems were indeed correct, and funding by this Vienna Science and Technology Fund and the Program for Evolutionary Dynamics at Harvard for having me there as a visitor and having much time to think and to write and to do nothing but science. Thank you very much.
Suppose you sample individuals from different places and you find the allele frequencies are different in different deans. How are you going to know whether this is maintained by selection acting in some complicated way in different places, or whether it's just to do with turnover of neutral alleles, or doesn't even need to be neutral alleles. It could be that the selection is very simple, but it's the same in both places, but the reason the things are different is because the things are not in equilibrium.
I mean, without further information, I can't draw conclusions. I mean, I can't draw conclusions, but it's not obvious that they are going to be correct. And with uniform selection, even if you are in equilibrium, you can maintain different alleles at different places. For instance, if you have underdominance. If you have underdominance in each of the two deans, in one deem, the A allele may be near fixation, and in the other deem, the B allele may be near fixation. Just because you started with different initial frequencies, and
you know what I'm saying? I mean, if you look at real data, you're almost bound to see different allele frequencies in different places. And
yes.
And how do you explain it? How do you know whether this kind of selection is important to explain it or not?
I guess you can't do it without further information, because first of all, you don't need you have to have a guess if you are close to equilibrium or not, and you need to know about something about your selection. I mean, of course, if you could measure selection in the two deems and see that in one deem one of the alleles has higher fitness, allele A has higher fitness, and then the other deem allele B has higher fitness, then that's the most parsimonious conclusion. But without, yeah, without knowing something about fitnesses of the alleles, it's going to be very difficult to see anything. I mean, and even if you looked at, yeah, whether you had something like sweeps in each of the deems, I'm not sure if that's going to help. I mean, if you look at the haplotype structure and variation at linked sites. But I guess eventually you can't draw a conclusion unless you know something about selection and fitnesses. I mean, you could conclude that you had selection going on but actually I'm not sure, because all the sweep literature just assumes there's a simple sweep and no basically no geographic structure. I mean, there are models with migration that have been developed with migration, but if you look at the signatures under some kind of balancing selection, I guess almost nothing is known.
But it does highlight the danger of not considering demic models of selection when you think there might be selection operating some polymorphic trait.
Yeah.
In the sense that in reality, it's hard to know how to map the mathematical notion of a deem to the actual mating structures. Real populations, but for many species, one imagine there's a lot of deems, a very large number, and certainly many fewer alleles at any locus. So you're not even anywhere close to what's possible here. There may be two alleles, there may be fewer. Consider all a locus that has three or four amino acids every. Okay, so there's five alleles segregating. In a species that has a worldwide distribution, very large in the cell. In that case, presumably these models are quite strong or generically easier to explain that polymorphism.
Yeah. I mean, and concerning detecting signatures of selection, there's a little bit work done on by Hermison on these soft sweeps, where it's from standing genetic variation, but that's a different situation, because here you get balancing selection.
Right. And I want to say, just going back to Gillespie, and I thought he made very convincing arguments about for many types of gene products in this fitness function may often be concave.
Yeah, but you may note here another diff. I mean, this here, assume that's not team independent dominance. So here you have different dominance in the two deems. So that's. If this occurs, then it occurs for somehow complicated reasons, either because of some kind of epistasis or evolution of dominance or whatever. So this makes it even more hard to believe that that's something frequent in nature. But who knows? I mean, if you have just two deems and and two alleles and selection has been operating for long, then it's very well possible. But it's very unlikely. Would be something interesting, but I would only do it numerically. I wouldn't even start with an analytical model. So I would try to get funding for a postdoc who is able to write efficient, very efficient and good programs and understands population genetics. And I mean, I've done this with Sasha Kimofarb for a single panmictic population. And this took a couple of years and many CPU years of computing time by using 20 or 30 computers at the same time during semester breaks and things like that.
That was a few years
ago. Yeah, but of course one gets more and more ambitious. So. And with two teams, we need more than twice as much time, much more. Okay, thank you very much.